Hello, welcome to Beyond Reproach. I'm Stephanie Domingo.
And I'm Tux Lurzel.
And we be drinking and we be swearing. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. And we have a special guest here with us for this episode. We have Josh from the Bloody Beaver podcast. Hi, Josh.
Hey.
This is our first time having a special guest, so please bear with us. Hopefully the sound is great. We are drinking essentially a whiskey soda, right?
Yeah, it's basically a whiskey soda.
Or it's called a highball.
We'll get into that in a second, but yes, it's called a whiskey highball.
But Josh, you have your cocktail, correct?
Oh, I have mini cocktails.
We're going to cheers real quick.
Cheers.
Ta-da.
Ta-da. Cheers.
Cheers.
To whiskey. Mm.
And technical issues.
Yes.
Oh, man.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
It's a simple cocktail, but we still had some translation issues, I should say.
Yes.
I told Josh that we were doing a whiskey soda, and to Southerners, soda means Coke. To Northerners, it just means bubbly water.
Part of that's my fault. I didn't really read what you said correctly.
It's fine.
And also, whenever there's soda to Northerners, down here it's just Coke.
Okay.
And when I say Coke, that's literally everything. That's Dr. Pepper, Pepsi, Sprite.
Wow.
Everything is Coke.
Yeah, I've heard that that's a Southern thing.
Yeah, if you come over to my house and I'm like, you want a Coke? I'm going to ask you what kind of Coke you want.
Wow, that is so... I'll have Sprite flavored Coke, please.
Exactly. What kind of Coke?
Yeah, that's definitely a Southern thing.
So what Stephanie and I are drinking is whiskey and seltzer.
Soda water.
But Josh is drinking whiskey and Coke. When it comes to the origins of older cocktails from American history, the origins are hard to pin down. When it comes to the highball, Jessica Norris says that most folks agree that the highball started out as a sparkly brandy cocktail with the English gentry in the 1790s, when Johann Jakob Schwepp had first set up his soda shop in London. Some say a bartender named Patrick Gavin Duffy brought the drink to the U.S. in 1895 in the form of a scotch and soda. The name highball is also a bit of a mystery and has kind of like a shaky origin story. One story claims that it started in 19th century English golf clubs where the word ball meant whiskey.
Oh, okay.
And high referred to the tall glass that it's served in.
Yes.
Other people say it may have come from 19th century railroad signals. On American railroads, if a globe or a ball was raised high on a signal post, it signaled to the conductor that the track was clear ahead and that the train could pass through without stopping in the station. As dining cars started serving cocktails in tall glasses, they took on that name. So if you're going to go on an American railroad, you're going to drink a highball because it's like a train thing.
Oh, okay.
So what is a highball?
Delicious.
True. That's generally when I go out drinking. If we're going to go to the bar, I drink a whiskey soda. A highball is a little bit more complicated than that. Generally, it has to be served in a tall, narrow glass that's between 8 ounces and 10 ounces, and it has to have plenty of ice. They're usually mixed in a ratio of about one part spirits to 2 to 3 parts soda. In Esquire's 1949 Handbook for Hosts, Dave Woodrich says to use a tall glass, preferably uncolored, definitely sparkling clean, admirably narrow-mouthed, so soda does not collapse ahead of schedule.
Okay. Mm.
He says that you fill the glass with several large ice cubes, add the liquor, cold sparkling water, and most importantly, spare the spoon and save the drink. He says that silverware will squelch the bubbles.
Okay.
And that the carbonation itself is enough to do the mixing unassisted.
Hmm.
So no spoon necessary.
Fair.
The original American highball was made with scotch and soda, but any whiskey will do. Today, the word highball can refer to any number of simple mixed drinks. A rum and coke, a 7-and-7, a gin and tonic, whiskey and ginger ale.
Mm-hmm.
All of those would classify as a highball.
Yeah.
Essentially, the recipe
Coke.
Is spirit carbonated something or other, a
Bubbles.
Coke.
Yes.
and ice. That's it.
Easy.
Even a few more sort of slightly complicated, like a Dark and Stormy or a Paloma that's grapefruit soda and tequila with a little lime and salt. All of those could also be considered highballs. But today, we're drinking whiskey and plain old seltzer.
Yes.
We're drinking bourbon. Are you drinking bourbon, Josh, too?
I'm drinking Maker's Mark whiskey.
Bourbon.
Fancy.
Yeah.
And what's crazy is I went to junior high with a kid named Highball Jackson.
Oh!
Really?
And,
that is such a southern...
Yeah.
That person, to me, is in like some sort of tall tale. Highball Jackson. The legend of Highball Jackson.
He had a stutter, and I kind of feel bad about making fun of him over it.
Oh.
Yeah.
What did he... Like, people called him Highball? Was there like a nickname?
No, I just made all that shit up.
No, you did not.
Sorry.
Really?
Yes. This is classic Josh right now.
Amazing.
He makes up the most amazing stories that are in parallel to real life, but fantastical. And he gets me every time.
Well, I tell you when I'm just fucking off.
Did they call him High?
Let people know.
Oh, man. That was a good one, though. You had us.
My bad.
You could use rye in this, too. It wouldn't be quite as sweet as bourbon, but it's going to taste good with soda water. It's fine.
Yeah.
Plain whiskey soda highballs are also oddly really popular in Japan right now.
Oh.
I learned this in my research. Basically, like, there are some high-end bars in Tokyo that have perfected the art of making a highball into an art form. And there's, like, these elegant steps.
That is so Japanese.
Yeah.
They're so meticulous.
And yeah.
They just perfect everything. They really do. Repetition, repetition, repetition.
But the way we're drinking them today, plain soda water, whiskey, ice, that's it. That also would have been really popular in the early 1900s in America. And our story today is from the 1910s and 1920s.
Yes. So, Josh, do you know about Ma and Pa Ferguson?
Oh, yeah. The name rings a bell. Keep going.
Fantastic. I was worried that you knew all about them because you are a history buff. I'm sure it's something that you learned when you were in like grade school.
Hit me with it.
So this scandalous couple, they both made histories in their own way. Governor Jim Ferguson, who eventually went by Pa, became the first person in Texas ever to be impeached. And then the Mrs., who went by Ma Ferguson, very conveniently became the first female governor of the state. She openly campaigned as a stand-in for her husband when he was impeached, and she won. So they were quite the pair. These two are some of the most colorful and divisive figures ever in Texas politics, which is saying a lot.
It sure is.
Yes, it is.
So this scandal, much like our guests, is very Texas, but also very unlike Texas, at least according to these two Yankees who have only ever been to Austin. Josh is from Conroe. He is the real deal, you guys. He says words like holler, and he's always fixing to do things. So James Edward Ferguson was born August 31st, 1871 in Salado, Texas, in Bell County. Josh, do you know where that is?
It's not near me. That's all I know.
Texas is big as hell.
It's big as fuck.
It's freakishly large. But apparently it's near Temple.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So he went to prep school at age 12, but he was expelled at age 16 for disobedience. So he wandered out west for work. 2 years later, he returned home and he decided that he was going to become a lawyer. How does someone who was expelled at age 16 actually become a lawyer?
Texas, that's how.
Exactly, yes. It's Texas, and also he had a hookup. When he was 26, after no formal study, he received his law degree because the chairman of the bar exam knew his father.
Mm-hmm.
Must be nice, right? He could just become a lawyer because his father is like friends with a dude.
Why not?
Texas.
Texas. High places.
So on New Year's Eve, 1899, he married Miriam Amanda Wallace. His law practice left him with a bunch of free time, so Mr. Ferguson got into real estate. He dabbled in insurance, and later he turned his attention to banking. He started two different banks. He started the Farmer State Bank, but then he sold it and established Temple State Bank. Throughout his years in banking, he took an interest in local politics, as one does when you're a banker. You want to buy a little bit of influence. Although he had never held office, he was not a stranger to political problems. Problems like when the government tells you you cannot drink and you want to drink.
Oh,
he
yeah.
yearned to be free. Free to drink. So he worked very hard to keep prohibition from his county.
That he sure did.
Not on his turf.
So in 1914, Jim decided, even though he'd never run for political office before, he thought, you know what? this seems like a really good time for me to run for governor. It was the same foolhardy confidence that made him rich that also made him think that he could run for the highest office in the state of Texas and win. Unlike Huey Long, who had started at the bottom and worked his way up to governor, this dude was like, nah, I got this.
I got it.
And he wasn't wrong.
Yeah.
His upset victory over a much more qualified congressman was surprising to some, but Jim Ferguson knew how to get people on his side. Even though he had never run for office before, he had helped with other political campaigns. He also talked a good game. He knew how to market himself.
Yeah.
And how to exploit other people's interests for his own personal gain.
He was a politician. Natural politician.
You know what politician means, right?
No. Oh, do you?
Oh, no, man. No. Oh. Dad joke coming in hot. Ooh. Polly, meaning many, and ticks, meaning blood-sucking fucking insects.
Oh, yeah. Wow, yes.
I know.
Yeah. It's all right.
All right.
Love it.
So, for one thing, he saw that his opposition was running on a prohibitionist platform, and he kind of correctly...
Sorry.
I want liquor. He sort of saw that... Maybe the guy was overestimating the popularity of prohibition,
mm-hmm.
and he figured that if he ran on a platform of neutrality, he could win the votes of the wets, aka booze hounds like us,
yes,
and the campaign dollars of the brewing companies. And he was right.
Yeah.
Not only that, but even though he had grown up a prep school kid who went on to become a banker and a lawyer, on the campaign trail, he started going by Farmer Jim because he was trying to flatter the poors and court the, quote, creek bottom vote.
Cute.
He knew he didn't have the backing of the political establishment. But at this point in Texas history, nobody was really trying to mobilize the rural poor and the working class. So he figured he'd go for it. He knew there was a growing resentment against the ruling elite. And he figured it wouldn't matter that he was actually part of that elite as long as he could convince the poors that he was one of them.
That sounds a little bit familiar, Tux. But maybe I'm just imagining things.
I don't know what you're referring to. Just like Huey Long, who we've talked about in episodes 11 and 12 of the show, he won the election because of a visceral connection with these white rural voters and small town good old boys that most of the people referred to as dirt farmers at the time. I recently saw something on TV that said a lot of politics is just going on to flatter your voters. And that, you know... That's true today, but it's also, that was true 100 years ago.
Yeah. It's such an emotional connection that it's not really about facts as long as the politician that you're supporting makes you feel good about yourself. Like, that's really what it is.
Yep. I feel like when it comes to politics, they basically just say what they want their people to hear, you know? They know their base and they're just pandering to the lower percentage sometimes, I think.
Lowest common denominator.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Where was I?
God damn it, Tux.
Fucking whiskey. I'm going to blame whiskey.
Yes. Why isn't there prohibition right now?
Yeah. This would be so much smoother. Basically, he went on to appeal to their perceived status and explained to these the poors that it was the wealthy who were keeping them down. But Farmer Jim was here to help them turn things around and make their lives better. And this strategy worked.
Yeah.
Once in office, he did try to keep several of his campaign promises. He passed a law that protected sharecroppers by limiting the amount that landowners could charge their tenants. Unfortunately, this was later struck down as unconstitutional, but he did try it, at least.
Did.
He also set aside state funding to build a bunch of new rural high schools. And he made school attendance mandatory. Not surprisingly, he also vetoed every single bill that was designed to tighten the state's liquor codes. Liquor codes.
Not on his watch.
Yeah, not today, Satan.
Yes, not tomorrow either.
Yeah. This guy was a very popular figure. Mm-hmm. He was a man of the people.
He was doing the populist things.
But in reality, he was actually doing more to support the needs of the urban industrial interests than he really was the sort of like rural poor.
Rural.
Rural. Rural agricultural poor. But perception is reality.
Yes.
And farmers big and small loved this dude. He had almost no trouble winning a second term in 1916, despite the fact that his opponent had accused him of buying groceries on the state's dollar.
That yes. son of a bitch.
Which he 100% was doing. Basically, when Ferguson first took office, the legislature had to pass a bill to kind of cover the tab that was left over by his predecessor. There was a small tab that had some like services and minor expenses, butter, eggs, horse feed, car repairs, and stationery. And since the state legislature agreed to pay for it and not go after the previous governor for it, Ferguson was like, well, fuck, if this guy can do it, why can't I?
Yeah.
But he didn't stop at eggs and horse feed.
No.
He bought some seriously luxurious shit.
He was a man of taste.
Yes. You know, much like me.
Yeah.
If I knew the fucking state was going to pay for shit, I'd be like, I'll have.
Yes.
I'll have cashmere sweaters, please. He bought car tires. He had like a New Year's Eve party catered. He bought records for himself. Yeah, and he even bought a ukulele.
Dude, you can buy your own records. Yeah. But okay.
Wait, hold on. Okay. Hold on. He bought a ukulele?
Correct.
A ukulele.
Correct.
Oh, fuck yes. Yeah. I like this guy. Go on.
Of course, he also did buy himself a bunch of groceries because yes. a man's got to eat.
Man's got to eat.
And Texans didn't give a shit. They were reelected him.
It's like the man buys a ukulele with tax dollars and they're like, yeah, he seems cool.
Well, to be fair, we generally don't give a shit about a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Case in point. So, though he had signed legislation creating three new colleges, he quickly found himself at war with the professors at the University of Texas.
Oh, shit.
Ferguson accused faculty members of mishandling funds, which is hella rich coming from Mr. Groceries. I guess game recognizes game, but throughout this whole scandal, I just kept thinking, this man is doing crime wrong. He's like pointing at other people being like, you're mishandling funds, where he's buying a ukulele and records and groceries.
We have said this on the podcast several times before, but like, do crime better.
Do crime better. He was angry that several professors had openly criticized his very corrupt administration. Ferguson demanded that the president of the university fire them. The president refused. And he publicly called for an end of political interference in educational matters. He was kind of like, dude, stay in your lane. What are you doing over here?
This isn't
your job. You can't control who I fire or not.
Why are you here?
Yeah. So when he couldn't get the board to override the president's decision not to fire the professors, he went into full meltdown. In classic mega petty retaliation, he vetoed the entire appropriation bill for the university. So he basically said to them, like, how does, like, $0 for the year sound? Like, are y'all cool with that? However, in his defense, he was planning on being really hungry that year and he needed the money for groceries.
I get it. Butter's expensive. Especially, maybe it's cheaper in Texas, but damn, in Brooklyn, that shit's like $6 a pound.
Dude, butter's expensive as fuck when you want to get the good shit.
Yeah. Yeah, the good shit is very, yeah, like the thick Irish butter.
Oh, yeah.
That's not all watery. Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of cattle in Texas, though. They're not eating that Irish
true.
Shit.
Yeah, hey, that's true.
That's
yeah,
fine, but those cattle ain't in my fridge in the form of butter.
So this very public fight with the university rightfully launched the massive scandal. Students at the Austin campus marched on the Capitol calling for an end to Ferguson's tyranny, basically. And powerful alumni, they also swung into action. They basically called on the legislators to deal with Ferguson, like, come get your boy. He's acting crazy, like he's over here thinking that he controls this university. So he was soon indicted for misappropriation of funds. He was forced to defend himself against 21 different articles of impeachment. Many of the charges were weak, but four were pretty substantial and pretty damning. He definitely did these four things. Well, the first is Ferguson's UT appropriation veto. That was unconstitutional because, duh. You can't control who the university fires.
Duh.
What?
He just kicked a hornet's nest for no reason.
Yeah.
And it blew back on him. So, second, the House charged that the governor had illegally funneled state funds to use for personal debts, which he did. He spent almost $6,000 to pay off debts using Texas money. He did that.
Crime better, dude.
He was
what
feeling
are you
himself.
Doing?
People loved him. He was going for it. So he was also charged with having illegally deposited state funds into his own bank to the tune of $100,000 deposited into the Temple State Bank. Yes.
Insane.
Yeah. He personally profited from this transaction because the bank wasn't paying interest on the funds to the state of Texas. And again, he's just like, oh, I didn't know I couldn't do that.
Nobody specifically told me, yes, don't steal money from the state and put it into your own bank.
He's like, point me to that law that says you can't do that. So finally, the House charged that Ferguson had accepted another bribe of $156,000 from brewing interests in 1916. He insisted that this was a loan, in air quotes, a loan that was never repaid.
Yeah, it was, you know, that kind of loan that you don't ever have to pay back.
Amazing. I need better friends to loan, air quotes, from. He refused to reveal that this loan, I guess, again, this loan that's in air quotes, came from six different Texas breweries and it was just a bribe, clearly a bribe. So Governor Ferguson maintained that the charges against him were unconstitutional because the House didn't include the subject of impeachment in their session notes, in their agenda for the meeting.
You got to look at the fine print.
Yeah, well, had they, again, this is not in the laws that they must do this, but had they said, like, dude, we're going to impeach you at this session, he wouldn't have showed. He wouldn't have.
And he's like, oh, it's unconstitutional because you didn't tell me outright.
Yes.
Hey, we're about to impeach you. Yeah. You better show up for this shit.
Yeah. He defended himself against these charges because, again, he's a lawyer. And you know what they say about lawyers who defend themselves, that they have a fool for a client. He was such a fool. We all know how that went. He was impeached. However, he submitted his resignation the day before he was scheduled to be formally convicted. And
oh, you can't fire me. I quit.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not mad at him. I feel like this is how you do it. You realize that you're guilty because duh. And then you resign. And you're just like, I never wanted this job anyways. And laws are for squares. I give it a 10 out of 10. What do you think, Josh?
I feel like there's something in the news lately about impeachment, but I can't remember what it's all about. I'm definitely not a square.
You're mistaken. Well, all this was to no avail because just a few hours later, the Senate found him guilty on several of the charges and he was removed from office and barred from ever holding office again that was authorized by the state constitution. So the lieutenant governor, William P. Hobby, he took over.
I'm not exactly sure what Josh is referring to, but I think that his main problem here was that he didn't put the entire state Senate in his pocket before these impeachment proceedings began.
I don't know what either of you are talking about, maybe. So I'm just moving. I'm moving along.
See, that was his first mistake.
I think you both have been drinking too much.
Yeah. I'm drunk as fuck. Just add on to that the fact that I never know what I'm talking about.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think that makes three of us.
Yes. So, Jim, he returned to his hometown. The only impeached governor in Texas history now became a publisher. He launched a weekly paper called the Ferguson Forum, which he used to basically decry his enemies and promote liquor sales, promote drinking. Yes. Tux is like, is it still in circulation? Yes.
Liquor. I hardly know her.
His opponents called the paper the Ferguson for Rum.
Can I, like, how much is subscription cost? Do they deliver to New York City?
Ferguson, he still wanted power. Being a publisher was not enough. He went to court maintaining that his, like, ban from state office was unconstitutional. He challenged Hobby, who was lieutenant governor. He challenged him in the primary of 1918. Ferguson ridiculed his opponent's big ears and short stature because he's that mature. A grown man being like, you have big ears and you're short. Yeah. Hobby answered and he said, I will admit that the supreme being failed to favor me with the physical attributes pleasing to Governor Ferguson. But at least he gave me the intelligence to know the difference between my own money and that which belongs to the state.
Ooh.
Shots fired.
He went there.
Shots fired. But Ferguson, not to be undone, he objected to the construction of tennis courts at the governor's mansion, and he suggested that a cow lot was more appropriate instead. However, Hobby responded again that, quote, it's too bad that the ex-governor didn't think of the milk cow pen when he was in office. They say in those days he confined his milking activities to the public treasury. K.O.
Oh my God.
K.O.
Returning petty with petty.
Truly. And like, killing it. This is like Mortal Kombat and like, he's done.
Finish him.
Fatality.
Fatality, yes. So the ex-governor, he lost both battles. Like, he got clobbered by Hobby, and also the Supreme Court upheld that the ban was constitutional. And yet, Ferguson refused to yield and would reemerge in the 1920s as a dominant figure in Texas politics. He even ran for president in 1920 as a candidate for the American Party, which no one has heard of. He's the only one in it.
And it literally, was, no one.
He only made it on the ballot in Texas. So needless to say, he lost against President Harding.
Is that the American ballot or the American ballot?
The American Party.
Basically, yes. It's the American Party.
But thank God we had Harding, because this show has been sponsored by Warren G. Harding.
Harding is a gift to this podcast.
Yes, like, he absolutely just, is.
By leaps and bounds, he's so good. So when a court suit blocked his entry into the primary of 1924, because again, he's trying to win the primary in Texas, even though he's barred. It's ridiculous. Farmer Jim said that his wife would be the next governor.
With her husband sidelined, Mrs. Ferguson announced that she was fixing to run for governor.
Fixing to.
Good job on the Texas talk.
Actually use fixing in my everyday life.
Just be natural with it. Go with it.
You have to be confident.
Drink 4 whiskeys and just say fixing to.
Feels good. It feels good when it comes off your lips. Fixing to. I'm fixing to go over there and start the fucking washing machine. See?
Wow, works for everything.
For everything.
So Miriam Amanda Ferguson was 49 years old when she decided to enter politics to, quote, vindicate my husband's good name. It was a little tarnished, but she figured she could polish it with her with a little spit.
A little bit of spit goes a long way.
Even though she was hitched to a corrupt former governor, her upbringing had not really prepared her for life in politics. She'd been raised in a middle-class farming family, and she was sent to Baylor College for Women to train for the role of a dignified social lady.
Oh, yes.
Rather than campaigning on her qualifications, the Fergusons came right out and said, look, this candidacy is a means to return Jim to the governor's mansion.
Yeah.
They even had a slogan, 2 governors for the price of 1. When it came to her folksy nickname... During the campaign, a reporter wrote an article about her and switched her name, Miriam Amanda, and used her initials, M.A., instead. And Ma stuck. Initially, she privately hated the nickname, but it
Wants to be called Ma?
Yeah, seriously. Especially
by strangers.
Yeah. But it inspired this, like, matronly image that really did have an effective appeal in the same rural and small town communities that were won over by her husband's Farmer Jim shtick.
Yeah.
So with Miriam full on the Ma train, he switched from farmer to Pa.
So cute. I love that they're just doing a bit, the two of them.
Ma and Pa Ferguson.
I'm picturing them in that, like, American Gothic picture, like holding a pitchfork.
Yeah.
But it's like, dude, you're a banker. Like, nice fucking try.
She's a dignified social lady.
Oh, yes.
Perception is reality.
True.
Exactly, yeah.
Unfortunately.
It wasn't long before cars all over the state of Texas were emblazoned with bumper stickers that said, Me for Ma. And usually they had a tagline, and I ain't got a darn thing against Pa.
I like that they say darn thing.
It is literally written out, D-U-R-N. I ain't got a darn thing against Pa.
Oh, Texas. I love it.
Hey, man. That's a legitimate word.
So you hear darn, like...
Oh, fuck yeah. There's a difference between damn and darn. Like, you know, sometimes you want to calm it down a little bit. And
it's like language you use around your grandma.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it's like dang.
Well, it depends on your grandma. Because there's some grandmas that they don't want to hear it darn or dang it either.
But then there's other grandmas that are okay with you being like the goddamn motherfucking shit.
Yeah.
Oh, dude, there's other grandmas that'll be saying that to you while they're beating the shit out of you. Yeah,
exactly.
Yes. Yeah. I had one of those such grandmas. There you go. She's from Alabama. She did not play. I would have to get my own Switch.
Hey, You got to go out there and get your own Switch, man.
She was not there for my games.
No.
I learned very quickly. She was not my mom.
Yeah. I feel you. I feel you. Oh, man.
The upstate cold Germanic people that I come from, we just get like a look.
Oh, we're like, what?
I'm not mad. I'm disappointed.
Ooh. Wow.
Where are you from?
Auburn.
Upstate New York. Near Syracuse, kind of.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's called Auburn.
I got you.
Big German family.
Big German family, man.
Yeah.
So his grandpa, like, doesn't hug.
Oh, man.
Just so German. Like, not emotional.
Zero emotion.
Yeah. His grandpa likes to shake his hand, which I think is insane.
Now that he's older than 90, like, he finally hugs now. Because I've been like, no, you're my grandpa.
Like,
I'm going to hug you.
We know each other. Like, I'm not going to shake your hand.
That's kind of cool. I kind of like that, though, because...
Why?
Because it's like the older...
Very natural.
I'm kind of an anomaly in that I didn't know either one of my grandpas, and I wish I did.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So it'd be... I think in my mind it'd be so cool to be able to shake my grandpa's hand, and
but never to hug either, though.
Like, no,
you
no.
To hug him?
Yeah, I would prefer.
Are you
not
a hugger?
No, you're right. You're right. Yeah, because I know on my father's side, my grandpa was a very hard man. Never told his children he loved them. Nothing like that. Would physically beat him and shit like that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
With me growing up, my dad that grew up in that environment, I got hugged. He told me he loved me, all that type of stuff. So I grew up in that type of environment where I was told I was loved. But still, I feel like it would be real cool to be able to shake my grandpa's hand. I don't know. Good old maker's mark.
All right. That's, that's the power of whiskey. Yeah.
So on the campaign trail, Miriam Ferguson, much like her husband, made a lot of big sort of Huey Long-like promises of like... investments in infrastructure and education reform. She also made promises that she was going to better manage the state's finances, which shouldn't be hard considering her husband had lowered the bar so much.
They just like grift a little less. And she's like, I did it, you guys.
I got it. Just slightly less crime.
Mission
and we're good.
Accomplished.
So vindication was kind of the real reason behind their 1924 campaign.
Yeah, it was vengeance.
Yeah. But their biggest sort of like most publicized campaign issue was taking on the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes.
Oh, shit.
Peak? All shit is right.
Yeah, no. Yeah. The Klan was at their peak in the 1920s, with some estimates saying that they had upwards of 4 million members nationwide by 1924. But the invisible government of the KKK was feeling pressure from all different sides. There was a lot of attacks coming at them in the 20s after these big damning newspaper reports that were put out by the Baltimore Sun. They detailed stories of murder, rape, and arson in the paper, and the Fergusons once again read the public mood. During a campaign speech, Ma said, "Hate has been the slogan of the opposition. Venom is its password, and slander, falsehood, and misrepresentation its platform." The KKK struck back, calling Miriam a kitchen drudge and saying that she was only qualified to stay home and feed her chickens rather than trying to run the largest state in the union. The KKK was well-funded, a well-oiled machine, and they struck back at her with such intensity that the failing New York Times felt the need to remind their readers that Miriam Ferguson was no country bumpkin. This was a cultured, educated, intelligent woman who was capable of quietly and efficiently running a household filled with servants, not to mention the fact that she was married to a governor for several years. Now, admittedly, I don't know much about Texas in the early 1900s.
Yeah, me neither.
But I thought that taking an anti-Klan stance would have been a losing strategy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It turns out, though, after we did a little bit more research, the real issues at hand here were booze versus xenophobia. This was already, this is 1924, so the Volstead Act was already in place for 4 years. Prohibition was already a law.
Yeah.
But apparently in Texas, there were no laws, so they were kind of like...
it was like, it seemed like it was county-based, which makes no sense because it's a national law.
This is
law.
A federal law, yeah.
Texas does its own thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it didn't matter. They did what the fuck they wanted to do, basically.
I mean, yeah, exactly. That's what it seemed like.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about a 1924 election. The law had, this is federal constitutional law.
Oh, damn.
That had been in place for 4 years already. So this sort of rowdy drinking culture of the working class saloon was largely dominated by immigrant men. And the KKK and other people who favored prohibition feared that mass immigration posed a threat to a white Protestant American way of life. They also saw that the large brewing companies were run by German immigrants who were also seen as un-American.
Yep.
They targeted
their drinking habit. With their leader hosen and their delicious beers.
Beer making bastards.
Exactly.
So they targeted the drinking habits of people who they saw as enemies of, quote, 100% Americanism.
Yes. The un-Americans shouldn't be drinking, but Americans are fine to drink.
Basically, Catholics, foreigners, and African Americans. They thought that if they could stop them from drinking together socially, they could also stop them from muddying the waters of white American life and culture. So on the campaign trail, Miriam adopted her husband's anti-prohibitionist stance, despite the fact that she privately did believe that there should be increased restrictions on alcohol.
Yeah, she was a team player.
And she kept her own personal shit to herself, which she needed to do. Mm-hmm. Like, girl, shut the fuck up. Everybody wants a drink.
Yeah.
Kick rocks, nerd.
Yeah, exactly. So it was their opposing views on prohibition that kept the Fergusons at odds with the Klan. And then with this whole, like, Ma Ferguson thing falling into place, she was basically playing, like, she was no longer Miriam Ferguson. She was playing this, like, cartoon role.
Yeah. She's and wearing bonnets.
She's feeling it. She's feeling herself. On the campaign trail, she's wearing a sunbonnet to all of her rallies.
She's all of a sudden, like, so matronly.
Yeah. She's even inviting the press into her home to watch her can peach preserves.
Oh my God, I love it. The theater of it is really, really fun.
At a solid 5'5", with gray-tinged dark brown hair and brown eyes, she was perfectly at home on the campaign trail. In fact, in the crowd, she shook so many hands that her right arm swelled to twice its size. And all this handshaking paid off. She won the election by almost 100,000 votes.
Wow.
Of course, her opposition, they couldn't have that, and they tried it.
Yeah.
They tried it. There was an 11th hour court suit to have her candidacy disallowed because of the so-called common law disability against women in office. But the district court ruled that even though her husband was legally entitled to her salary, that was no reason to stop her from running for office and winning governorship.
Yeah.
They also ruled that even though her husband had openly said that if she were elected, he intended to be the one running the government.
I like how not shy he was about just like being in
charge. He was out there saying shit. Yeah. And the judge was kind of like, well, yeah, he said it, but like, that doesn't mean he's going to do anything about it. The judge actually said, and I quote, "If everyone were held responsible for his campaign statements, then nobody could be elected to any post."
I mean, he's not wrong. I mean, it's really cynical, but he's not wrong. People be lying.
They definitely be lying.
The state Supreme Court affirmed the decision, and on November 4th, 1924, Mrs. Ferguson accepted her victory after beating the strongest Republican opposition since Reconstruction.
Wow. So how was she in office?
A perfect angel, right? She was the best.
Was she scandalous like her husband?
No, she made promises and she stuck to them.
Well, no.
Let me interject here. She was definitely as scandalous as her husband.
Exactly.
Everybody was back then. She knew what the fuck was going on.
Exactly. Yeah. She was playing the same position like her husband.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. So the most sensational charge against her concerned the awarding of enormously profitable construction contracts. Specifically highway construction contracts. She awarded them without any competitive bidding. And the people who won them, they just so happened to be donating to her husband's newspaper. They just happened to be buying advertisements, like, in large quantities, maybe spending a lot of money on the Ferguson Forum. Just so happened. It was just...
Yeah, that's weird. That's a weird coincidence.
Totally random. What a
weird coincidence.
Such a weird coincidence, you guys. Don't look too much into it. Like, you're imagining things. So no one was ever indicted, but a number of these contracts were eventually rescinded. So her first term saw few successes. Over 2 years, she failed to realize her campaign goals of reducing wasteful spending because, duh. I mean, duh. She's still doing, and her husband are still doing kind of grifty things. She also wanted to increase funding for highways and education, and that really didn't happen. She did support, and she signed an anti-masking law specifically aimed at the KKK, and she only, it was eventually overturned by the courts, unfortunately. She was also attacked for her extensive use of her power to grant pardons and appeals to parole. Ma had promised the voters that she would be more lenient about pardons than the previous administration. And this, for once, she wasn't lying about that. She was very, very, very lenient when it came to pardons and paroles. In her first term alone, she issued more than 2,000 pardons. 2,000.
2,000.
Yes. So there was a story that involved a father who approached Pa about a pardon for his son. While the man was apparently pleading his son's case, Ferguson kept talking about a horse he wanted to sell for an exorbitant price of $5,000. And when the puzzled father finally demanded, what does this overpriced horse have to do with my son's release from prison? Pa said, well, I figure your son might ride him home from the penitentiary if he bought it for him. Some of the pardons were issued before the convicted person even made it to prison. So it wasn't long before people began referring to the executive mansion as the House of 1,000 Pardons, which I
they need to put up one of those historical markers
that says the House of 1,000 Pardons, on the mansion.
Yeah.
So in Ma's defense, she insisted that most of the pardons involved people who were violators of the Volstead Act. So she didn't want to add to an already overcrowded jail situation. And plus, she said that the pardons were granted with the approval of the state board. So it wasn't just her. I mean, she was doing a lot of them, but it wasn't just her. And she was doing them for a reason, because she thought that people should be allowed to drink and not go to jail for it.
Yeah.
The combination of highway scandals and this unprecedented number of pardons had just 9 months into Ma's term. People were already talking about impeachment. There were rumors flying around. She said that it was just politics, totally just politics, not a big deal. Nothing
to see here.
Nothing to see here. I'm just doing regular things. However, her reply to a petition for a special session from 100 legislators was anything but a joke. She said, let them assemble if they want to. Let them start something. I'll still be here at the finish. Now about this special session they want me to call, they tried to camouflage it as an inquiry into foot and mouth disease and tick eradication. They must think I'm a bird. It's my feet, it's my mouth, it's my eradication they want. Some of them call me a dumbbell. They will soon find out how dumb I am. In spite of all that mush about me being a frail, delicate woman, they will see. End quote. Fighting words. she's weary of the okie doke that caught her husband, because he showed up to a special session and it wasn't in the minutes that it was going to be an impeachment. So she's just like, I know what you guys are trying to do.
Yeah.
I've seen this before.
We've been here. Done
we
this.
Have seen this before, yeah. I should say. So there were a lot of jokes about Ma and her impeachment floating around at this time. There was a joke that went, how does it feel to have a woman governor, when a popular joke? And the response is, I don't know, we don't have one.
Oh, shit.
That was a burn back then. That's, times have changed. So Ma was easily defeated in 1926 by her own attorney general. He immediately had the legislator void the amnesty law that she had passed 2 years before to restore her husband's political rights. Because, again, he still wants power. He wants legitimate power. And she had passed a law that said that he could run again. So I guess the thought was she would finish out her term and then he would run, because she made it legal. So the lieutenant governor is like, no, we're not.
No, we're not doing this.
I'm sick of y'all. This is illegal. So Texans, it seemed, were upset at reading about the press conferences conducted by Pa, who had no official title, but was seated in the governor's chair, because he was writing about this in his newspaper. He was writing that he was passing laws from essentially her chair.
What are you doing?
Dude is telling on himself.
Do crime better.
Yeah, they're real.
Do crime better.
They're really
Why
bad.
Are you doing this?
They're bad at crime.
Snitches get stitches.
They're snitching on themselves before Instagram. You know how people are getting in trouble on Instagram? They're putting all of their ill-gotten gains, taking pictures and uploading it to Instagram, and cops are like, what you doing?
He Me Too'd himself 200 years earlier.
Yeah,
exactly. Basically.
Yeah. There is no phrase that says snitches give themselves stitches.
There should be. There should be. So Texans, they were sick and tired of all of this mess. They were tired of being embarrassed by this like proxy government. They were tired of having this governor who was not the real governor. They were sick and tired of it. They were done.
Were they though?
Oh, well.
Are we sure about that? In 1930, Ma tossed her famous sunbonnet back into the gubernatorial ring and Texans were into it.
Absurd.
She led coming out of the first primary only to actually lose the runoff election to an oil magnate named Ross Sterling. But Pa was unperturbed. He said, "Our motto is never say die, say damn." 2 years later, they were back on it again, back on the campaign trail. And this time, she actually won by the narrowest, squeakiest margin.
Yeah.
4,000 votes out of almost 1 million.
Wow. Oof.
And before long, the Ross Sterling forces had asked the courts for time to investigate the nearly 100 pro-Ferguson counties where the votes cast outnumbered the poll tax receipts.
Ooh, how does that happen? That seems fraudulent. Okay. Yes.
Nothing to see here.
Avert your eyes.
Yeah. But Ma weathered the storm, and on January 17th, 1933, she raised her right hand, and for the fourth and thankfully, last time, a Ferguson was sworn in as the governor of Texas.
Unbelievable.
Just fucking scandal on scandal on scandal on scandal.
These two, the end. Texas.
Messy boots.
Yeah, we like to stack it up down here.
Truly.
Everything's like, bigger in Texas.
I'm not going to learn from my lesson.
We learn from our lessons, but it's a hard fucking lesson, man.
Yeah.
Because that's one thing I've learned from doing my podcast. Dude, you had no justice in Texas before like the year 1900.
People are just doing what they want.
Everybody just did what the fuck they wanted. With Ma Ferguson, there's a female governor of Texas. I can't remember which one it was, but she literally went in there and fired all of the Texas Rangers.
Oh.
And now I'm wondering if it was Ma Ferguson, because it was around that same time.
It could have been her, yeah.
It could have been her.
It must have been her.
Yeah, I think it was her, because she was the only female governor for a while, for like decades and decades.
She either fired them or they all fucking quit under her reign. Like, they were like, fuck her, we're not going to serve her, whatever the fuck. And then in her response, in Donald Trump fashion, was to be like, well, I'm going to fire you. How about that?
Yeah.
This is just like her husband. Like, you can't fire me, you quit. But the other way around, you can't quit, I fired you.
Exactly, yeah.
I guess our drinks are empty, so.
That one really took it out of me.
Whiskey is very drinkable and delicious.
Facts. Big facts.
Yeah. All the ice is melted, so you actually can't hear the little swirly sound.
Yeah, there's literally not even ice left in the glass. We have sucked out every last drop from these glasses. So we're gonna take a little break, put some more ice in, as well as some more whiskey.
Refresh our beverage. Yeah. We will be right back.
BRB.
Yes. I feel like we need a yeehaw in here somewhere.
Yeehaw.
I can't say it convincingly, just like holler.
Give it a try.
Yeehaw.
Yeah, that's good.
It's pretty swing good and a miss.
No, I feel like that was a good yeehaw.
I think Stephanie has this sort of like performance anxiety when it comes to anything Southern sounding.
But I can say y'all because I've been saying y'all my whole life. Yeah. Y'all doesn't feel like like theater, but like fix into. My mom says it all the time, but like I just can't.
Huh. Is it your mom from the South?
Yeah, she's from Alabama. She's from Tuscaloosa. Or Tuscaloosie, she says.
Tuscaloosie.
All right. Josh, it's your turn. You're up. Tag, you're it.
We're back.
We're back. What number drink are you on? Because we're really...
Oh, Lord.
Oh, you're like, I've lost count.
I'm on number. I'm fucked up is what I'm
okay,
on.
Yes. Yeah, yes.
Exactly.
Similar. We're getting there.
Same.
So here we go. Today's tale is a sad tale.
Oh.
But it does possibly have what I consider to be a happy ending. It's about a man named York. And York doesn't have a last name because he wasn't really considered to be a human being at the time.
Oh.
York was a slave. Born into slavery, and because of that fact, you know, we don't have a definite birth date or whatever.
Yes.
But a good guess is that he was born sometime around 1770.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Okay.
That's similar for women, too. Like, a lot of women don't have birth dates because who cares?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, who cares? Yeah, I don't know how many slaves were all total in the history of the United States. I did read about 600,000 were brought from Africa and shipped here.
Yeah, but then the great thing about the great thing, you know, they make more.
That's what I was about to say.
Yeah.
Enslaved people make more enslaved people. So yeah, it's great like that. Fun times.
Don't you wish iPhones could reproduce?
Right? Why do I have to keep going to the Apple store when my shit breaks up?
I kind of freak out about Apple phones like becoming self-autonomous and then wanting to murder us. That's why I keep a gun loaded.
You would.
Luckily, they don't have hands.
Yeah. So yeah, like you said, the slaves had slaves.
Yes.
And then their children had slaves. Their children,
correct,
grandchildren had slaves, all that type of shit, right? These are the forgotten. We don't know their names. We don't know their life stories. We don't know shit about them. We know they were there. We know they existed. But the reason York is recorded in history is because he was a participant in my favorite thing in the world to talk about, the Lewis and Clark Expedition.
Oh, okay.
Oh, cool.
Shit. That's
yes.
Right.
Yes.
I talked about it a little bit on my podcast, and I'm sure your audience is probably already aware.
They should be. Yeah.
But no, the Lewis and Clark Expedition. Just a quick rundown. In 1803, the United States purchased the Louisiana Territory.
Yes.
Which took up most of the interior of the United States.
That's like Florida to like Arizona, right? It's like the bottom half.
Dude, no. That's like Florida to Canada. Florida,
yeah, it went all the way up to and across from like...
Damn.
From like Ohio to, I don't know, something. Wyoming, something.
I didn't know it went that far north.
Look up St. Louis, Missouri, and then just scroll west all the way to the Pacific Ocean. That's what it was.
Wow, okay.
It's everything. If y'all are saying like, oh, I didn't know that, you know, neither did they. That was the big thing. Nobody knew what the fuck was out there.
Yeah, they had no idea what they were going to find.
They had crazy ideas, dude. They were talking about looking for the lost tribe of Israel.
Oh,
crazy
yes.
Shit like
the
that.
Black Israelites. Yeah, oh, so man. Weird.
But yeah, we didn't know exactly what we bought at the time. So President Jefferson got Captains Meriwether and Lewis and William Clark to lead an expedition from St. Louis all the way to the West Coast. One of their main tasks was to find an all-water route, which we know now does not exist. I talked about this a little bit on a previous episode on my podcast. They did a lot of exploring. They identified plants, animals, stuff that was then unknown to science. They studied various tribes they encountered along the way.
I was about to say they found a lot of natives living their lives because they were there for millennia. Go on.
For years and years, yeah. The Lewis and Clark Expedition, it was a huge undertaking. Like, it's the equivalent of, we're going to go to fucking Mars right now. Like, that's what it was.
Seriously.
That's how unknown this territory was at the time. The reason York, who we're talking about, was a part of this expedition was because he was Captain Clark's slave.
Oh, okay.
And that's not a situation where Clark just went to the flea market and one day he was like, yeah, let me just pick up a slave. No. York was born as Captain Clark's slave. York's father was Clark's father's slave and childhood companion. Likewise,
okay. Yeah.
With York, he and Clark grew up together. They played together. And that's just the first part of like where the scandalousness comes in. At one point, these two were just kids. They were just playing outside, throwing pine cones at each other, wrestling around in the river, shit like that. And then at some point, Clark, the white dude, he got older and realized, you know, he was a master. And also at some point, York had to come to the realization that he and his friend are at vastly different stages of society.
That's crazy to think about, the like growing up with someone like that and then suddenly realizing like, oh, but also I own you.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that was the situation right here.
I'm also your boss and I'm not paying you.
And I'm not even a fucking human being, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
So, yeah, anyway, 1804, the Lewis and Clark expedition is getting underway. Both captains were handpicked by Thomas Jefferson. This was a huge deal. Like I said earlier, it's the modern day version of a group of explorers going to Mars or whatever. The men of this expedition were well vetted. They were real picky about who they picked to got to go along. Everybody had to be in great shape, yada, yada, yada.
So I couldn't go?
Damn it.
I mean, push-ups can you
do? No, I have no upper body strength. My hands are just decorative.
Yeah, you can't go. You're fucked. There was Sacagawea. She was like 14 and pregnant, and she got to go along, so.
Lucky her.
Lucky her. Other than Captains Lewis and Clark, there were about 22 other dudes that went on this expedition. You know, I just mentioned Sacagawea, young Native American lady that would accompany them, along with Lewis's dog, Seaman.
What was his name?
Seaman.
Wait, what? Seaman. What's his name?
His name is Seaman.
Like Seaman?
Like Seaman.
Yeah, so in preparation for this podcast, I did look into seeing why Captain Lewis named his dog Seaman. Like, was it like a nod to the Navy, like a seaman, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Turns out it was not. He actually had several dogs before Seaman with similar names. Names like Jism, Love Batter.
No.
What? Yep.
Baby Juice, Cum.
Oh, my God, no.
I'm telling you, Man Milk,
no,
the Devil's Nectar. Excuse me.
Go on.
My jaw is on the floor.
Truly, his jaw's in the sub-basement.
He had a blue healer that he was extremely fond of, and that blue healer's name was Penis Pudding.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, my God.
So by the time his new dog came around for the expedition, Seaman was the only nickname he had left. Yeah, I'm obviously fucking with y'all right now.
Okay. That's what I thought.
Some of you are like waiting.
I am nodding at Tux being like, don't fall for this. I listen to his podcast and this is what he does. He strings you along and it seems kind of believable. Like, you get me every single time. There's a few times when you insert like rap lyrics and then you don't get me because I know what you're saying. But like,
what rap literally lyrics?
Every other time when it's not a rap lyric, you get me with your lies.
All right. But I admit to it.
I'm over here like, there's no way that this is a joke because we've given you so many opportunities to be like, no, I'm joking.
Yeah, no, you see.
But I admit to this shit. I'm obviously joking.
Yeah, no, you do. You
shit,
do.
Right.
Yeah.
Eventually.
But also, if you look back, it's so clear. Because why?
I wanted to be like, wait, they were saying come in like 17.
Yeah, that should have, yes.
All right.
You got us. You got me for a while, but then I'm like, I've been down this road before.
Let's get back to Mr. York. According to Stephen Ambrose in the book Undaunted Courage, York was described as being very large in stature, very dark-complected, strong, agile, and a natural athlete. And he was extremely useful during the expedition. Here's where we get into the next layer of the scandal.
Okay.
He was, in all intents and purposes, in equal standing with all the other members of the expedition. He carried a rifle.
Oh.
That was almost unheard of when it came to slaves.
Oh, wow. Shit.
He was sent out on his own to hunt, just like the other members of the expedition. He killed buffalo, another game. He scouted, etc. And when it came to friendly relations with the Native Americans, York was instrumental. According to author Stephen Ambrose, quote, York was a sensation. His size was impressive enough, but the Acara tribe had never seen a black man and couldn't make out if he was man, beast, or a spirit being.
Oh.
Huh.
York played with the children, roaring at them, chasing them between lodges, bellowing that he was a wild beast caught and tamed by Captain Clark. The captains finally told him to stop because, quote, he carried on the joke and made himself more terrible than we wished him to be. The men of the expedition enjoyed the favors of the Arica women.
Yes.
Meaning they stuck their penises in the women's vaginas in a vigorous motion.
Okay.
Often encouraged to do so by their husbands, who believed that they would catch some sort of the power of the white men from such intercourse.
Yeah, this was the thing. It was very weird.
Basically, they thought they could like transmit it from the wives to them. The men of the expedition were considered big medicine or good luck, and especially was the case with York. One warrior invited York into the lodge, offered him his wife, and even guarded the entrance while they got the freak on. And this happened the entire way west.
It's a different culture. The women had a lot of power, and like the women were attracted to like certain men.
The women were like, oh, damn.
I mean, kind of.
Kind of think it was the other way around.
Oh, you think it was the other way around?
Sadly enough, I don't think the women had much choice in these encounters.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
You know, so you're an Arica warrior, okay? And you have this strange, huge black dude come into camp. And you're like, this dude's magical. This dude's like some otherworldly type of person. I'm going to make my wife fuck this dude. And then,
like, how could I get his essence?
Right. And then later on, when I fuck him, or when I fuck her, sorry, when I fuck her, that power is going to be transferred to me. And I think the ladies probably didn't have too much of a choice in the matter when it came down to it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of shitty.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of.
Well, you know, they're women, so we... it's rare that we get the upper hand in most
Right. Yeah, and that's the, you know, doing my podcast on the Wild West, women got a really bad shake of the hand.
Well, especially in the West, it's all like prostitutes and...
Yeah.
Yeah, that, and that's the whole thing,
like,
man.
The best you could do is like a madam.
Yeah.
Women were fucked up. Black people were fucked up. Everybody was fucked up.
Yeah.
But it's like the worst of the worst that nobody ever talks about is the Native American women during this time frame.
Yeah. Shocking.
Well, even to this day, that's literally like one of the most disenfranchised parts of our society is the Native American women.
Absolutely.
Nowadays, you have women trafficking, human trafficking. A lot of people go missing. It's fucking insane.
There's a lot of campaigns about all the Native American women that have gone missing recently. You see... They do Absolutely. Like a handprint over their mouth. Yeah, it's fucked up.
Yeah, it's fucking crazy. Like, Tux, how many Native American women have you ever met?
One.
Yeah.
In my entire life. Yeah.
Same.
How about...
One.
Same with you, Steph.
I've only met one person in my entire life, and I met her when I was in Ohio when I was like 15.
Same
this
here.
Was a friend of mine in college.
She was friends of my mom. It's
and we
crazy.
Live in America.
And I feel like one is more than most people. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Oh, no. Look up North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, Wyoming. They're all over the fucking place. That's the problem. Get on YouTube and look up the current fucking living conditions of a Native American in South Dakota, Pine Ridge Reservation. The worst ghettos that you can think of do not fucking compare.
Yeah, it's not good. And I'm aware of it. But yeah, it's shameful that I only know one Native American person. I've only met one Native American.
Well, that's not shameful for you. I mean, you're living your fucking life. It's just, you know, who we happen to meet. But the only shameful thing, I think, is the fact that we as a society in this country.
Yeah, we've ignored them. We've put them away and just like we say that they're gone and they're not gone.
They're not gone. They are still there. On my podcast, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more.
Great.
On New Year's Day, 1805, the first winter, they had a big shindig. They busted out a trombone and a fiddle.
Fancy.
And they got their party on like it was 1799.
Good year.
Clark called on York to dance. Quote, which amused the crowd very much, and some astonished them that so large a man could be so active. So just by earlier depictions of York with the Native American children and all that type of stuff, roaring and scaring them and all that, you can kind of tell he was clearly enjoying himself at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, you know, he was a curiosity, but he was no longer amongst a people that viewed his skin color as a negative. You know, something that made him less human.
Yeah, it was a positive sort of curiosity, like, ooh, you're new.
But when you read about all the other times that Clark and Lewis made York dance, I kind of wonder if that shit didn't start to get real old real fast.
I'm sure it did.
Yeah, I'm sure.
The Nez Perce tribe have carried on an oral history about trying to wash the color off of York's skin.
Okay. Wow.
And this goes well into the 20th century. Quote, they called him Raven's Son for the color... and the mystery that he embodied. In one Nez Perce legend, recorded as late as 1966, members of the tribe wanted to slaughter the party when it emerged from the Bitterroot Mountains, but feared retaliation from, quote, the black man. When the expedition needed horses to cross the Rocky Mountains, the Shoshone tribe were unwilling to barter with Lewis until he promised them a glimpse of the God damn it, man.
Extraordinary?
Oh, okay.
Extraordinary York.
I'm way too drunk.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Have I been drinking some whiskey? That's just what we know about the times that York was present to save the expedition.
So he was like a bargaining piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, big time.
I will give you this if you let me look at him. Yeah. Like, weird, but okay.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And there's no telling how many other times he was instrumental in the expedition's success. When the expedition finally reached the West Coast at present-day Washington State, there was a little bit of disagreement between the captains as to what would be the best location to set up their winter camp. Lewis wanted a camp close to the sea. His theory being, like, the closest upriver you got, it'd be a little bit warmer. Plus, he wanted to render salt from the Pacific. And being camped on the coast meant that they had a chance to maybe make contact with another vessel and possibly get a quick ride back east. Clark disagreed.
Yeah, you fools don't know where the fuck you are.
Yeah, seriously.
So they put it to a vote. And what makes this vote interesting and relevant to our topic is that both York and Sacagawea were given full and equal votes on this.
I feel like there's a difference between, like, when you're at home in America in normal society versus when you're essentially like you are in space. You're like out in the middle of nowhere. There's only whatever 20 of you or so on this boat.
You are all that you all know.
Yeah.
Like this group of people is like essentially America.
Exactly.
Like whoever is with you.
And everyone's pulling their weight. So it's not quite as easy to be like, well, you don't count.
Yeah.
When you're like, oh, I need you to like do a dance for the Shoshone tribe.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I agree completely. And you're absolutely right. Everybody gets a fucking say, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine how York felt at this time.
I'm sure it was like terrifying. He's out in the middle of nowhere and they have no idea what they're getting themselves into.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it had to feel pretty, you know,
I'm level. Outside the system.
Yeah.
These people think that I'm a person as well.
Yeah.
And then I get a vote.
According to author Stephen Ambrose, this was the first ever vote held in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh. Hmm.
It was also the first time in American history that a black slave had voted. Hmm. And the first time a woman had voted.
Whoa.
That's insane. Yeah.
That's crazy.
I did do a quick Google search, and it's not exactly true. A woman had voted way back in 1756.
What?
Yes, ma'am. In Massachusetts. Evidently, she was allowed to do so because she was a widow and she was rich as a fuck.
Okay, I'm like, how? But how and why?
And her son was a minor, so the townspeople felt like her family should be able to cast a vote. The first African American that officially voted in a U.S. election would be a guy by the name of Thomas Mundy Peterson. And that was in 1870, over 60 years after York cast his vote on where to camp. And I know that voting on where to camp is such a trivial thing, but like I said, just imagine how he felt. The expedition, of course, headed back east after the winter, and when they arrived back in St. Louis, they were considered heroes. The white men of the expedition collected their wages and rewards and vast land grants. And this is where the scandal gets in. York just went back to being a slave.
Of course.
Is that a scandal?
It's fucked up today.
Okay.
At the time, that was just like, okay, yeah, obviously.
It's like Tuesday.
Yeah.
Because
it's scandalous by today's standards.
He wasn't paid anything for his services. Okay. He wasn't awarded any land.
Obviously not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He didn't get the 40 acres and a mule.
Well, duh. Yeah. Maybe his ancestors will one day. But yeah, no. That day is not today.
You know, the captains were dining with rich people and famous people after the expedition.
Yeah.
And all the other members were being bought drinks in saloons and taverns. And York was just ignored. He was expected to just quietly going back to being a servant. And understandably, this didn't set so well with York.
They could have freed him as like
they were about
a
doing
payment.
The right thing.
Oh, man. I mean, do I have a story for y'all? York began demanding his freedom as a reward for his services. He had gotten married at some point before the expedition, and his wife was sold to another master and shipped to Louisville, Kentucky. Of course.
Tale as old as time, yes.
And of course, Clark refused to grant York his freedom, but kind of as a concession prize, he would let him visit his wife in Kentucky, but just for a short visit.
Hmm.
In a letter Clark wrote to his brother Jonathan in 1808, he said, quote, "Send York and permit him to stay a few weeks with his wife. He wishes to stay there altogether and hire himself, which I have refused." And this is just me talking right now, but when you talk about hiring yourself, you're basically hiring out your slaves and you're pocketing the money. They don't keep any of that shit.
He's like, I'll work for somebody else just so I can like be where I want to be.
Oh, yeah.
Even though I'm not going to get paid for my labor.
Yeah, that's a loss.
At least I can offer to work for free for someone else.
Clark went on to write, "He prefers being sold to returning here, but he is serviceable to be at this place, and I am determined not to sell him, to gratify him, and have directed him to return to this place this fall. If any attempt is made by York to run off or refuse to perform his duty as a slave, I wish him sent to New Orleans and sold, or hired out to some severe master until he thinks better of his conduct. I do not wish him to know my determination if he conducts himself well." So fucked
up. Jesus.
Clark is so insulted by the fact that York wants to be free that he'd rather see his loyal servant, his childhood companion, mistreated rather than entertain the idea of setting the man free.
It's real petty.
That's petty as fuck.
I'm sure by those standards in that day, that was just like, But today, it would be weird for him not to feel that way, I guess. Yeah.
As York would continue to demand his freedom, Clark would later write, quote, "I did wish to do well by York, but as he got such a notion of freedom and his immense services on the expedition, that I did not expect he would be well to me of service again." In another letter to his brother, he wrote, quote, "I do not care about York being in this country, meaning Missouri. I have got a little displeased with him and intended him to be punished, but Governor Lewis insisted on my only hiring him out in Kentucky, which will perhaps be best." And I could just imagine Clark bitching and moaning to Lewis about
it.
Lewis, by the way, by this point, was half fucking insane.
Was he?
Oh, fuck yeah. But he somehow still made...
He, like, makes more sense than Clark still in his madness.
Yeah, he managed to be a voice of reason. York wasn't the only slave that was getting under Clark's skin. At one point, Clark even considered selling all of his slaves just to be done with all the frustration, as he put it.
They assholes. Just, like, want to be compensated for all the work they do for me.
What are they talking
all
about?
All the money they
what
make
the
for
fuck?
Me.
How dare these human beings expect to be treated like human beings?
I know, right? Exactly. Seriously. Basically, in May of 1809, York came back to St. Louis, to Clark.
Okay.
And writing of his return, Clark said, quote, "He is here, but of very little service to me. Insolent and sully. I gave him a severe trouncing the other day, and he is much mended." So this man, York, was a huge part of the success of the expedition. You know, he demonstrated numerous times that he was willing to lay down his life for Clark, his childhood companion, and he was now being beaten like an animal. The whole situation reminds me about the Thomas Jefferson quote, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." And like I said earlier, you know, Jefferson chose the captains, and Jefferson wasn't a fool. He had his own slaves, and he had his own controversies, but yet he was an intelligent man, right?
Yeah.
We can look back on shit that Thomas Jefferson did and said, and some of it's inspirational, some of it's motivational, and some of it's, this dude was a piece of shit.
He was notoriously brutal to his slaves, and he refused to free them on his death. So yeah, he was garbage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like I said, there's a lot of his writings we can look back on. It's like, oh, okay, this makes sense. This
His writings were aspirational. They weren't about his own life and what he was doing.
That's what's strange with this whole thing, because to me, this is my favorite part of history, Lewis and Clark Expedition. I fucking love it.
Yeah.
And I always felt like Captain Clark was kind of a hero. And then you learn about what I'm talking about now, how he treated York. It's like he's a fucking piece of shit, you know?
Yeah, there are no heroes in history.
There's none.
Yeah.
Oh, my
really.
God.
There's just men and women. They're just people. Often very shitty people. Sometimes amazing, but they're just people. They're not gods. They're not the thing of myth at all.
Oh, my God. I'm going to quote you so much on that. Because that's so great.
It's true.
Yeah, it's very true. Yep.
Yeah.
We are standing on the shoulders of freaks.
Humans.
Assholes. Other assholes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But one thing we can agree on is history is complicated and you have to learn from your history or you're going to fucking repeat it. York eventually got his freedom.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Sometime between probably 1811 and 1815. And this is where we get a little bit murky in history again. So there's two versions of York's fate. According to Clark, during an 1832 interview with Washington Irving, Clark said that he granted York his freedom, and it was that freedom that caused Clark's downfall.
Huh, okay.
Clark explained that York started a freight company business once he was freed, but it was a failure. Quote, "He could not get up early enough in the morning. His horses were ill-kept. Two died. The others grew poor. He sold them and was cheated. Entered into service. Fared ill. Damn this freedom," said York. "I've never had a happy day since I got it." He determined to go back to his old master. Set off for St. Louis, but was taken with cholera in Tennessee and died.
Holy shit.
So, you know, there you go. The old narrative, we know better. There's no possible way a dumb slave could survive on their own without, you know, kind, gentle master.
Yeah.
The soft bigotry of low expectations.
He was the white savior in this narrative.
Yeah.
Yes.
There's zero indication than any of the writings of York that he was inadequate.
I mean, if he was inadequate, he wouldn't have come on the journey. So
exactly.
Yeah.
He was as heroic as any of the other men on the expedition. Then there's the other version. The one I hope to God is the real story about York's later years. And this is not a conspiracy, not something I'm making up. This is plausible and it is backed up by eyewitness accounts.
This isn't like Highball Jackson?
Man, Highball Jackson back in junior high?
Yes.
He tried to beat me up one time when I was sharpening my pencil.
Yeah, that guy sounds like the worst.
But no, in 1832, a mountain man and trapper by the name of Zenas Leonard was passing through the Rocky Mountains when he met an elderly black man living among the Crow tribe in Wyoming. This man claimed he had first come to the territory with Lewis and Clark. And there was only one black man that came west with Lewis and Clark, and that was York. The idea of a black man living in the western North American territory isn't that much of a stretch. You find it all throughout history.
Yeah.
In this history, particularly the fur trapping era of the 1830s, you had famous black men like Edward Rose or Jim Beckwith. And both those guys were born slaves, and they came west, and they lived a life of freedom, just like York. In their later years, they rose to the rank of chiefs among the tribes they lived with. The Rocky Mountains and the frontier didn't have anything in common with the civilization back east at that time. Out west, you were stripped of everything. Only the bare necessities of life mattered. You had to rely on yourself and your companion, and it didn't matter if you were white, black, orange, or whatever the fuck. And by and large, the other mountain men didn't care either. As long as the man that was riding inside of you was capable and steady, nothing else mattered. And that's why men like Jim Beckwith and Edward Rose became chiefs among their people. The fucking skin color did not matter. So maybe York did try his hand at freighting. Maybe his business did fail. And maybe then he set his sights west. I mean, hell, he had all the necessary skills.
Mm-hmm.
He knew how to survive. He knew how to communicate with the natives. He knew and understood their culture. And he knew the freedom that their lifestyle embodied. I talked about it before on my podcast, but nobody was ever as free as the Native Americans who inhabited the Western United States during this time. You know, before disease and Western expansion, all that took them over. And just kind of going off script right now, I talked a little bit on my podcast about the book Tribe by Sebastian Younger.
Oh, yeah. Younger.
Yeah. It's a great book. Love that fucking book.
Good things about that book.
And he talks a lot about, like, what is it about the Native American society that there were so many people, white Americans, that were fleeing to that society and trying to join it, but it was never the opposite way.
Yeah.
There were never Native Americans trying to join white society. And they were still the epitome of freedom. And I hope that's how York spent his final years. I can see him chilling in a teepee, you know, covered in a buffalo robe, leisurely smoking his pipe.
Amazing.
As the fire crackles and hisses. Hope he had two or three fat wives to keep him warm at night, keep his belly full. This man had to return to, quote, savages to finally be treated as what he was, a human being.
Yeah.
A human that I hope got the respect he deserved in the later years of his life. If you're ever in Louisville, Kentucky, there's a statue honoring York there. Pretty cool looking statue. It's got him standing there with a rifle on the Riverfront Plaza. There's another cooler yet cryptic statue in Portland, Oregon that depicts York. It's not a very attractive statue, but on his back, instead of the normal scars from the whip you would expect from a slave, is William Clark's maps scarred onto his back.
Wow.
And I thought that was pretty powerful. You know, the artist replaced the typical scars you'd see on a slave's back with the maps that this man helped contribute to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In 2001, President Clinton made York an honorary sergeant of the United States of the Army. So his memory does live on. You know, we're talking now in 2020. We're discussing this man who served his country honorably. You know, we're recognizing him right now. So that's something. Clark would become an Indian agent, as well as the governor of Missouri.
An Indian agent? What do you mean?
So he was in charge of the reservations early on. Oh. So, like, think of Jackson was
all
pushing.
All you have to say is Jackson. I'm like, okay, this is some bullshit.
He was pushing the tribes west.
Yeah, of course.
You know, the Choctaw, Cherokee, Seminole.
Yeah, all of them. Yeah.
All of them. The Trail of Tears. He did try to do right by them. Compared to the later people that would come on and...
How, though? What do you mean?
Here's the sad thing about history. I can't tell you about what he did so great about him.
Oh, okay.
I can tell you what he didn't do. It's like, comparably, he actually did try to feed them and give them supplies and shit like that. To whereas the people that came after him made no effort whatsoever to give the Native American supplies. They just gave them bullshit.
Yeah.
Scandals and scandalousness, right?
Yes, truly. That's what we do here.
And that's where the shitty thing comes in with a lot of the shit. I always liked Clark. He seemed like a great leader during the Lewis and Clark expedition. And he did a lot of good things for the Native Americans, comparably to their successors when he was an Indian agent. And it's like, God damn, man, I want to like this dude. But then you look at how he treated a fucking childhood friend.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, how does this...
Yeah, it's hard to compare history to, like, current day, the way we would look at things today. But at the same time, you also, there's that phrase, like, don't meet your heroes.
Yeah. Yes, like, that's like, yes.
FDR, there's so many things that I want to love about FDR, but he was such a fucking piece of shit on so many ways.
Yeah. Heroes don't exist.
No. Amen, Stephanie.
Outside of, like, Disney movies.
I want to thank y'all both.
Yeah, so that was a great story.
Did y'all have fun at least?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's all I care about.
With technical difficulties, like still it was really fun. And we learned a lot.
I really appreciate y'all letting me do this.
Yeah.
I have no idea why y'all want to fucking talk to my ass.
Oh.
But I really appreciate it. I think all three of us come from very different backgrounds. And it's really crazy to me that y'all would listen to my podcast and actually want to share something like this. It blows my fucking mind.
I think it's good to have different perspectives. And I love your podcast, even though it's like really violent and super vulgar. I enjoy it.
Thank you.
I know nothing about Wild West history at all.
Yeah.
And you clearly love it. And it's just like, I hear that through your podcast. And it's exciting to hear someone love the Wild West as you do.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, coming on and telling this awesome story.
Yeah, sharing your Wild West history with us. I don't know a lot about Lewis and Clark other than like cookie cutter shit I learned in high school. So this was good to have like a deep dive and put like real personalities to these people back then.
I mean, it's a hard story, but it's like, it's real.
So many layers. Yeah, it was really, really good.
I'm glad y'all liked it.
Our drinks have been empty.
Our drinks, there's literally not even ice left in these drinks, but
there's a lemon left in mine.
But you know, an empty drink means, I guess we're done. America's history is juicy. We just add whiskey and soda.
And a lemon, right? A lemon.
Yeah.
The only thing that remains.
Thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
And
Josh!
One name like Madonna.
Yeah.
That's it.
Big, big, big thanks to Tim Clough.
The biggest thanks.
Our editor, sound engineer, and savior of this episode that was riddled by technical issues.
Praise him with a capital H.
Yes.
God bless you, Tim.
Till next time.
Bye.
Bye. Ta-da. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.